Devaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're going to read the second subsection of 54. As was shown to Brahma, Krishna expanded from his own body. Well, first the coward boys and calves were there, who were actually expanded from Krishna. Then Krishna had them all turn into four-armed Vishnus. These are temporary partial expansions. Partial in the sense that they're just partially revealing the Lord's personality. They're just four-armed Vishnu standing there, not doing anything. And they're just temporary ad hoc expansions, just for the moment. Still, even these temporary extra expansions are all, as described by Shukadev, purely spiritual, eternal, unchanging, and so on. So we continue with this. Let me read the verse again, spoken by Shukadev, because we continue the analysis of it. Satya Gyanananda Matraika Rasa Murtayaha Asprishta Bhuri Mahatmya Apihyupanishad Drisham. The Vishnu forms all had eternal, unlimited forms, full of knowledge and bliss and existing beyond the influence of time. Their great glory was not even to be touched by those who have the vision of spiritual knowledge. We already discussed yesterday Sridhar Swami's commentary on this, but Jiva Goswami has more to say about it in his own words. Atra matra padam tadvarna dinam sarupa antaranga dharma tvam bodayati. Here the word only, matra, indicates that the color and the other qualities of these forms belong to the essence of their inner selves. Okay, now only comes from the verse matra. Satya Gyana Ananta Ananda Matra. The forms consisted of Satya Gyana Ananta Ananda only, meaning not that there aren't other qualities also, but no contrary qualities, the opposite of them. Unreality, ignorance, limitedness, these are not present in those forms. So that's the significance of the word matra. Okay. This is a difficult word to translate always, sarupa. It comes from Sanskrit, the compound one's own form. But it has a special meaning, technical, philosophical meaning. It's the essence, the what something really is, underneath all the designations and all the appearances, what something really is deep down inside. It's real identity. But how do you say that in English? You know, philosophy in the West tends to be very vague. We talk about essences and ultimate realities, but these are not very... But what is that supposed to mean? Anyway, what we mean is Krishna's a person, his real personality underneath all the coverings and all the appearances, who he really is underneath, his swarupa. How are we going to say that in English? We have to struggle with it. So here I'm saying belong to the essence of their inner selves. That's not so great. Anyway, the varna, his color and his other qualities all belong to his what he really is inside. They're not just something on the outside. Continuing, na hi atra aparasminarte murti shabdak kevalatma para iti swamina shri shukadevasya vamatam lakshanaya kashta kalpana mayatvat. Okay, now, let me get into a little bit of a pretty complicated argument here. Logic of this sentence is quite complex. It is not the opinion of either Sridhar Swami or, going back to the author, Sri Shukadev, the speaker, that the word murti in this context, taking it in a different sense, refers to the absolutely impersonal self. You know, that they all were Satchitananda, not, you know, the same one and the same murti. We understand murti to mean that all these bodies were all spiritual. They're all God. Murti means body. But the Mayavadis would like to twist it and somehow get murti to mean something impersonal. That murti refers to the absolutely impersonal self. And Jiva Goswami is saying here that that's not the opinion of either Sridhar Swami in his commentary or Shukadev in the original verse. It's not what they mean to say by the word murti, something impersonal. Now, why not? Okay, it's not just an opinion being stated here. He gives several reasons, and they are as follows. Lakshanaya kashta kalpana mayatvat. This interpretation would involve a difficult presumption of indirect metaphorical usage. Well, because the word murti, when you look it up in the dictionary, it means body or personal form. The deity, you may claim the deity is just a doll, you know, if you're an atheist. But it's a personal form. A doll is in the form of a person. It may not be a person, but it's modeled to look like a person. That's what murti can mean. At least the image of a person, if not a real person. If not his real body, at least it's a make-believe body of a person. So that's the literal meaning of the word murti. Every dictionary will tell you that. Those who were with us before, we've discussed at length, we had our poetry class, and we discussed the different modes of meaning of words. I'll review this quickly for the new students. Of course, words, first of all, have their literal meanings. And very often, we use words simply in their literal meanings. You know, please turn on the fan. I'm not making any great mystic or poetic statement by that. I just want the fan turned on. It's hot. Please turn on the fan. The words there simply have their literal meanings. There's no need to get it, give a complicated interpretation of what's meant by that statement. What do you mean by that? Turn on the fan. I mean, please turn on the fan. But there's other ways in which words express themselves indirectly. Words can express more than their direct literal meaning, especially when you put them into sentences, especially when you're doing poetry. Poetry is language that goes beyond literal meaning. When I say her face is the moon, is like the moon, I don't mean that her face is, you know, so many thousands of miles wide and then it's got pockmarks all over it. I don't mean literally that her face is the moon. It's a poetic expression. That means there's some shared qualities. It's white and brilliant and cool in a cool way, effulgent, like the moon. So to say that face is the moon is a poetic way of going beyond the literal meaning. Or when Krishna calls Arjuna, O bull among men, Narapungava, it's not saying that Arjuna, you're just a stupid bull, you know, or that you got four legs. No, it's poetic. He's got qualities. He's got the strength and the courage of a bull. So words have to have a means to go beyond their literal meaning. And that is the two other modes of expression. The third one we'll leave for the poets. We'll discuss that in poetry class. But the second one is important in philosophy also. And that's extended meaning, or what do we usually call it? Which? Lakshana in Sanskrit, but how do we translate it? You can say metaphorical, but that's not right either. Indirect meaning, extended meaning, figurative meaning is actually the way we usually translate it, figurative. If I talk about the village on the Ganga, and we can do that in English as well as on Sanskrit, in Sanskrit, Gangayam Goshaha, the village on the Ganga, well, it's not a floating village on top of the water. It's really on the shore of the Ganga. So that's a figurative usage. It's not literal. We mean not actually on the Ganga, but on something that's closely connected to the Ganga, namely the shore of the Ganga. And so figuratively, it's on the Ganga. That's Lakshana usage. And it's not only resorted to in poetry. In ordinary language, we have to use it all the time. You can't have an intelligent discussion, express yourself very intelligently, only using literal meanings. We resort to figurative usage in almost every sentence we speak. I'm furious with you. Well, that means that I'm not satisfied with what you did, and I want to let you know it. But the literal meaning of furious is that you're completely lost your temper and you're ready to kill anyone who comes near you. So, we don't mean furious in that literal sense. When I say I'm furious with you, I could kill you. We're being figurative, I hope. In ordinary usage, not just in poetry. Okay. So that's what is Lakshana Vritti. When words mean something, not exactly what they mean literally, something close to it, something connected with it. There's a rule in poetics that Lakshana Vritti should not be used unless it has to be. If the literal meaning makes perfect sense, then you shouldn't resort to a figurative meaning. Turn on the fan, you don't have to speculate by what do you really mean by fan. It's a fan, that machine up there, turn it on. Okay, so here we have the word Murti. The impersonalists want to give a non-literal meaning, a figurative meaning to Murti. Not really a personal form, but the essence of the impersonal essence of the Supreme, that by some twist of, some word jugglery, we can make it to mean, we can give it the word Murti. So Jiva Goswami says that this is Lakshanamaya Kashta. What is it? I can find it here. Kashta Kalpana. It's a very painful, troublesome concoction. You have to really make up all sorts of excuses to explain why you're using a figurative meaning there, when the literal meaning makes good sense. Why not just let it be a personal body, Murti? And you have to go to quite some length to somehow force it to mean something impersonal. That's the first reason that Jiva Goswami insists that neither Shukadev speaking or Sri Goswami explaining what he spoke, neither of them mean to try to push this extended or figurative meaning. Also, let's see. Asprishta eti, buri mahatmyeti, api iti, upadishan drik iti, padachatushtayasyaiva, vyastasya, samastasya, sarasya, bunga, prasangat. This is his second reason for rejecting this far-fetched interpretation of having murti mean something impersonal. He says, in the phrase beginning asprishta, asprishta buddhi mahatmya, that line. That means, well, it's not the complete idea. His vast glories are untouched, inaccessible to those who get their vision from the Upanishads, those who see in the light of the Upanishads. For them, those people cannot touch his vast glories, or the vast glories of those personal murtis. So, in that phrase beginning as sprishta, untouched, this impersonal, figurative interpretation of the word murti would conflict with the proper meanings of the four components in that phrase. Apsprishta, burdi, mahatmya, and api. Those mean untouched, asprishta, whose vast glories? Buri mahatmya, okay, that's one, second. Api, also, and Upanishad Risham, the site of the Upanishads. Each of them indicates something contrary to the impersonal idea. And when you put them all four together into the idea, you put them together into a sentence that expresses a coherent idea, it's completely contrary to the impersonal idea. We may have to analyze why that's so, step by step. I think we'll look at the commentary below. I think it's explained there. Let me see. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I explained it in the commentary, how each of the separate and combined meanings of these four terms is contrary to any impersonal idea. But we'll get into that in the commentary. But there's a third reason why the impersonal interpretation of the word murti should be rejected. Yadva satya gana adi matraika. Oh no, I'm reading from the wrong place. Excuse me. Ukta prakarana anurodat. Okay, that's short. The phrase should be understood in accordance with the sense of the whole story. The story is about Krishna as a person having a pastime with Brahma, another person. And he's showing his personal opulences. Not he's not showing himself as impersonal. That's the story. So it doesn't fit with the whole line of the story to now try to explain that murti doesn't mean person or personal form. And also, finally, ata eva, no. Finally, the fourth reason. Te achakshat aksha vishayam swasamadhi bhagyam ityadi. No, this is the fifth reason. There's a sixth, fourth reason. There's a fifth one also. The fourth reason is te achakshat aksha vishayam swasamadhi bhagyam ityadi udarishyaman anusarat. And the phrase. Okay, and it should also, the phrase using the word murti should be understood in accordance with the description later to be presented. When later on, it's actually in the It's actually earlier in the Bhagavatam. But it's going to be discussed a little bit later here in the Sandarbha, how the four Kumaras saw Narayan when they visited Vaikuntha. And it said, they saw before their eyes the success of their meditation. That's going to be discussed a little bit later in the Sandarbha. We should understand what Brahma saw in line with what the four Kumaras saw. That they saw the personal form of Narayan, and that seeing that personal form was the whole success of their meditation. Even though they were meditating as impersonalists up to now, but when they saw Narayan in his personal form, they considered that the completion and success of all their meditation. If his form was not the real reality, and was not what we mean by the word Murti, then why would they consider seeing the personal form of Narayan to be the full success of their meditation? Why would they? Okay, that's the fifth reason. Fourth reason. And the fifth reason that Jiva Goswami is seeing here. Swasuka ityadi shri shuka vidaya virodat cha. And finally, and to interpret the word Murti impersonally would be contrary to the attitude of Sri Shukadev, who's the speaker here. We know the attitude of Sri Shukadev from the verses, including the one beginning, Swasuka. That's from the 12th canto. What is it? Swasuka Nibritam. Nibrita Chetas Tad Vidast Anyabhavo. That Shukadev was in impersonal trance. He wasn't interested in anything else but the absolute truth. But when he heard the Bhagavatam, his mind was completely diverted from that impersonal Brahman. That is the mentality of Shukadev, as described not only there in the 12th canto, but in the first canto and elsewhere in the Bhagavatam. If the word Murti referred to something impersonal, that would be contrary to the whole mood of Shukadev. Okay, for all those reasons, five of them, I think, Ata eva vishuddha vijnana ganam vishuddha jnana murtaye twayeva nitya sukha bodha tanau ityadi vakyani chana lakshanikaya kardartaniyani. Therefore, the words, the concentrated embodiment of perfect pure consciousness, these are different statements found, let me find the locations of them, 8, 7, 8, 9. These are spoken in different places in the 10th canto, in the 37th chapter, in the 27th chapter, and in the 14th chapter. These three different phrases or clauses. One is, the concentrated embodiment of perfectly pure consciousness. That's referring to the Lord's personal form. And whose form is perfectly pure consciousness? Another statement, that the Lord's form is purely spiritual. And a third statement from another part of the 10th canto. In you, whose unlimited transcendental forms are full of eternal happiness and knowledge. And other statements similar to these should not be sullied, that means made dirty, by reading them metaphorically. To try to take all these descriptions of the glories of the Lord's personal form, to be actually referring to something impersonal, would be corrupting them. There's so many statements in the 10th canto, elsewhere in the Bhagavatam, where the Lord's form is assumed to be completely transcendental. That's what we mean by Murti. Okay. Now this is quite a complicated analysis. This is the kind of depth of very detailed philosophical dissection that Jiva Goswami chooses to use in this second Sandarbha. The first Sandarbha was not as difficult. that here in the second and then in the third Sundarbha, he gets very deeply philosophical, enough to satisfy any pundit and to probably drive crazy any ordinary person to try to follow all this. It may be frustrating, but this is the level of deep philosophical analysis that Jiva Goswami wants to go to establish everything very certainly and clearly. Anyway, I'll read the commentary. The personal appearances of the Supreme Lord are spiritual only, matra, meaning that there is nothing about them limited by the laws of matter. Nothing about the personal forms of the Lord that's limited by the laws of matter. These appearances suffer no limits of time, space, or capability. And yet they are murtis. They're visible, with form and shape, appearing by their sweet will in the confines of time and space. So at least they're forms, they're visible, they have shape. What to speak of them being alive, of being persons? But murti can also refer to a dead object. Murti just means that it's visible and has a shape. These forms can enter material time and space without becoming limited, the forms of the Supreme Lord. Advaitavad impersonalists, unable to digest the idea of unlimited personal form, are forced to try to reinterpret the word murti. Although it is practically impossible to devise an impersonal meaning of the word. The impersonalists could attempt dealing with the concept murti as analogous to the English word person. The English word person comes from the Greek persona, the first meaning of which word in Greek is mask. It means a mask. For the Advaitavadis and others of their sort, personality is just a facade, behind which there is nothing real other than impersonal Brahman. The Advaita understanding of Vishuddha Sattva, Vishuddha Jnana, perfectly pure consciousness, is amurta, without form. Somehow they reason, this amurta, formless, contains the qualities of existence, consciousness, and bliss, and as a kind of container, because it contains these qualities. It doesn't have a shape, but it contains those qualities. Satchitananda. So it's similar to a physical form, because it's a container. And so it could figuratively be called a murti, even though it has no shape. It's invisible. It has no boundaries. But this is an absurd argument. How can a formless entity have qualities? Whatever has any qualities is in a real sense a murti, whether living or inert, abstract or visible. It is thus very difficult to screw out a figurative meaning for the word murti that can fit a description of Kevalatma, the supreme soul without any form. And then going on to the further arguments given by Jiva Goswami. How, moreover, can this formless Atma be what is expressed by the words, now let's look at the other words, what's expressed by the words Asprishti, Burdi, Mahatmya, Hi Api, Upanishadvisham? If the mere knowers of the Atma as impersonal cannot touch the Supreme's vast glories, there must be someone else who can. Okay, the Upanishadriks, the people who see with the eyes of the Upanishads, it said they can't touch the glories of the Murti. Now, if the Murti is impersonal, then that means that the knowers of the Upanishads can't have no access to Brahman, to the impersonal truth. Well, if they don't see it, if they can't touch it, there must be somebody else who can. Otherwise, with no one able to appreciate, the Supreme's glories would be useless. Somebody must be able to appreciate them. Sparsha, because asprishta, untouched. Well, sparsha, or touching, is done by the mind or the senses in connection with some object. When you touch, now you can touch physically. You know, I touched the cup. Or you can touch somebody's heart. That doesn't mean that I do open heart surgery and touch your heart. It means there's some emotional response. It's abstract touching or figurative touching. But in any case, whether it's physical or abstract, touching means that somebody's mind or senses has a connection with some other object. That's touching. But the amurta cannot be the object of perception. It's got nothing. There's nothing to see there. There's no qualities. So the amurta can't be touched by anybody. The amurta cannot have glories, which are specific qualities, and especially the amurta cannot have an infinite abundance of such qualities. Those who are upanishadrik, knowing nothing more than the impersonal supreme, here's another meaning of that phrase. It means those who know the Upanishads but don't know anything better than that, who only have impersonal understanding. Meaning knowing nothing more than the impersonal supreme, they cannot realize the full truth of Brahman. It must be possible, however, for them to correct their debility by some adjustment of attitude. Those Upanishadriks who can't realize the full glories of the supreme, there should be a remedy for this. They should be able to learn how to see the full glories by some adjustment of attitude. Because otherwise, their knowledge derived from the Upanishads would not be the standard means for achieving liberation that it is recognized as. The Upanishads are said to give knowledge that leads to liberation. If the Upanishadriks, who only can understand things impersonally, can never, by any means, ever actually contact the Supreme Truth or realize it, then the Upanishads don't serve their purpose. They're not what we claim them to be, or what they claim themselves to be. So there must be some way that the impersonalists can correct their debility, make up for it, and actually come to see the full glories of the Supreme. And then the word api is there. Mahatmyam api, that word is significant. It's not just a space filler. Api, indeed, or even. And even api, the adept students of the Upanishads cannot know the glories of Brahman. I'm sorry, if even the adept students of the Upanishads cannot know the glories of Brahman, then they are no better than ordinary materialists. Putting all these words together in a complete phrase, the meaning indicated is self-evidently inconsistent with identifying impersonally the Vishnumurtis that Brahma saw. Because each of those four terms by themselves are contrary to the impersonal idea, and especially when you put the whole idea together, it's completely inconsistent with the impersonal interpretation of the word Murti. So the word Murti, you have to consider what words follow it. In the next phrase, Asprishta Buri Mahatmya Api Upanishad Visham. You want to interpret Murti your way, but you can't. You have to make it consistent with the rest of the verse. Continuing, the praise of Shukadeva Goswami, spoken near the end of the last canto of the Bhagavatam, beginning Swasukha Nibrita Cheta, has already been cited in the commentary to Anuchet 46.6. Well, let's just find that verse in the 12th canto. What's the verse number? 12 something? Oh, Krishna.
12, 69? Yeah. Krishna.
So, swasuka nibrita chetas tad vidastanya bhavo pyatita rujiras lila krishna saras tadiyam vyatanuta kripaya yas tatvadipam puranam tamapkila vijinatnam vyasa sunam natosmi. Let me offer my respect. This is almost at the very end of the Bhagavatam. Sutta's offering his final respects to Shukadev. Let me offer my respectful obeisances unto my spiritual master, the son of Vyasadev, Shukadev Goswami. It is he who defeats all inauspicious things within this universe. Although in the beginning he was absorbed in the happiness of Brahman realization and was living in a secluded place, giving up all types, other types of consciousness, he became attracted by the pleasing, most melodious pastimes of Lord Sri Krishna. He therefore mercifully spoke this supreme Purana, Srimad Bhagavatam, which is the bright light of the absolute truth and which describes the activities of the Lord. Okay, and now going back to our Anuchid commentary. So that was the statement glorifying Shukadeva Goswami. Narada's prayer to Krishna after the killing of Keshi was discussed in the text of that Anuchet 46.6. The verse of Brahma's apology to Krishna. Oh, okay, that's different. So, Swasuka Nivritta Cheta, that verse is alluded to here. That we've discussed already. That comes from the end of the Bhagavatam. Also, there's Narada's words praying to Krishna after Keshi was killed. Now, what words are those? Swasuka, okay. Vishuddha Vijnana Ganam, I think. Where Krishna is being glorified by Narada as Vishuddha Vijnana Ganam, he who's the concentrated embodiment of perfectly pure consciousness. That was already discussed in the text of 46.6. I won't go back to that right now. And then Brahma apologized to Krishna after the pastimes of Brahma's bewilderment. And I think that's the words that include Vishuddha Ganamurti. Brahma says to Krishna, you whose form is perfectly pure consciousness. Now those words were part of Brahma's apology to Krishna after the pastime of Brahma's bewilderment, which includes the words Twayi Eva, that was cited in full in text 40.1. Twayi Eva. Oh, that's the third one. Twayi Eva Nityasukha Bodha Tano. Those are Brahma's words. That we quoted back in text 40.1. And pull up that one also. That's 9. That's 10, 14, 22. Brahma's words, glorifying Krishna. Yeah. Tasmad idam jagadashesham satswarupam swapnabam astadishanam pura dukkha dukkham twayeva nityasukha bodhatanavanante mayata udyadapiyat sad ivavabhati. Brahma prays to Krishna. Therefore, this entire universe, which like a dream is by nature unreal, nevertheless appears real, and thus it covers one's consciousness and assails one with repeated miseries. This universe appears real because it is manifested by the potency of illusion emanating from you, whose unlimited transcendental forms are full of eternal happiness and knowledge. Okay, and then there was the third phrase referred to here, just in passing. Whose form is pure consciousness? Vishuddha Gyanamurtaya, yeah. That is from Indra's prayer of apology after his defeat by Krishna's lifting Govardhan Hill. And here's that verse. Swachandopatadehaya Vishuddha Gyanamurtaye Sarvasmai Sarvabijaya Sarvabhutatmane Namaha. Indra prays to Krishna. And to him who assumes transcendental bodies according to the desires of his devotees. Unto him whose form is itself pure consciousness. Unto him who is everything, who is the seed of everything, who is the soul of all creation, creatures, the soul of all creatures, I offer my obeisances. So he said, whose form is itself pure consciousness? These were Indra's words. These three supplicants, people who are doing prayers, Narada, Indra, and Brahma, acknowledge the substantial reality of the personal form of God by referring to it as Gana, as Murti, and as Tanu in their respective prayers. Okay, that's enough for today. Are there any questions about it? We have a few minutes. Anybody catch any mistakes? Okay, keep your eyes out if you see something wrong. The book hasn't been published yet. It's not too late to fix it. Yes. Well, can we get the microphone? Is it ready?
Prabhuji, in the beginning part of the lecture, you were mentioning about the Krishna expanding into cowherd boys and cows, and you said that they are temporary. But later on...
It says they're all eternal.
Okay.
I meant temporarily manifest. Some of the forms of the Lord have their eternal Vaikuntha planets, where you can always go to Vaikuntha and see them there. You want to see Krishna on the chariot with Arjuna, you can go to the planet of Partasarathi at Vaikuntha. There's an eternal... There's a place where they're always on display. Other forms may be eternal, but they're not always on exhibit. They're only shown once in a while. Those are what we mean by temporary avatars. Not that they don't exist, but they're not on view all the time. So I presume that these forms of cowherd boys and calves were just thrown together temporarily. In other words, a temporary exhibit.
Okay. So do you mean to say that they're temporary in the sense that...
Temporarily visible.
Temporarily visible?
Yeah.
In the realm of where the pastime was happening.
Yeah, I don't know if they're ever shown anywhere else.
Okay.
Or if there's any other condition, circumstance in which those same forms were shown.
But at the same...
As far as I know, they were just for that particular purpose.
Okay. But at the same time, they are eternal, as you said. That means they're always existing.
Existing, but only in potential. You're not visible.
Okay.
Krishna's pastimes are all eternal. And there must be some... Okay, in Goloka, in the spiritual world, I guess they're all available all the time. Just like if you go on some airlines, you get your private movie viewer, and you can see any movie anytime you want. So in Goloka, all the pastimes are available all the time. Devotees can witness them anytime or participate in them anytime they want. And so Krishna can do any pastime he wants anytime. There's no restrictions. So okay, in Goloka, all the pastimes are always there, always visible to somebody. We're just talking about this material world, that these pastimes are only occasional. It's only for this one occasion. Krishna's appearance for 125 years, that's much more extended. But relatively speaking, the few minutes that these particular forms were shown to Brahma is just a very, very temporary. Relatively speaking. to the 125 years that Krishna was visible to everybody. But in the spiritual world, they're all visible all the time. Krishna is Goloka pastimes. Yes?
It may not be applicable, because I came in the middle, I just have a curiosity that Jiva Goswami is writing this refutation of impersonalistic understanding. Is it somebody have interpreted Bhagavatam like this because of that reason he's
yes.
speaking, or like what is the reason?
Yes, I mean he's bothering with this because the impersonalists, the Mayavadis, do meddle with the Bhagavatam. There are Mayavadi commentaries on the Bhagavatam. There, you can, if you want to just go out in the street, take 15 steps into the street, you'll see all the billboards, the boardings, the advertisements for Bhagavat Saptahas given by Mayavadis. Some of them are Mayavadis. They'll be up in the, yeah, see the picture with three-line dialogue, you know, advertise that they're going to speak on Bhagavatam. So the Mayavadis are still doing it. What to speak of having written commentaries hundreds of years ago? They're still doing it, trying to stick their nose in Bhagavatam. So for that reason, Jiva Goswami has to make sure that we understand the Bhagavatam completely pure of any such misinterpretations. It's not, he explains in the beginning of the Tapasandarbha, he's not very much interested in polemics, in getting into arguments with Mayavadis. It's not the purpose of the Bhagavatam to defeat everybody else's philosophies. That, other books can do that. Bhagavatam's purpose is to present us Bhagavatam. I mean, the Sandarbha's purpose. Purpose of Sandarbhas is to explain Bhagavatam and reveal Krishna. Arguments with non-devotees, that can be done somewhere else. But some things have to be dealt with. The Mayavadis is always sticking their nose in the Bhagavatam, and therefore any misconception that they may want to introduce has to be refuted. Otherwise, this book is not for defeating Mayavadis or anybody else, but just for defending the pure Siddhanta of the Bhagavatam. Okay. Shri Krishna Prabhu.
Prabhuji, you mentioned in your commentary this impersonalist, they are not better than materialistic.
Yes.
So are they same category or they have some difference between
them? Actually, it wasn't a simple statement that unconditionally the impersonalists are no better than the materialists. I wasn't talking about impersonalists. It was those people who were expert students of the Upanishads. If they can't know the glories of Brahman, then they're no better than materialists. So I wasn't even identifying them as impersonalists, although they probably are impersonalists. But people who know the Upanishads, if after all they're knowing the Upanishads, they can't know the real glories of Brahman, then how are they any better than materialists in that way? Actually, Mayavadis are much worse than the materialists. Better to be an honest materialist than to pretend to be a devotee of Krishna when you're really a Mayavadi. That's hypocrisy. Better to be an honest materialist than to be such a spiritual hypocrite. Okay? Okay. Okay, we're 1 minute over time. We'll have to stop. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai.